Accession number 28776, Reel 20.
Admiral Ray Ligo, Reel 20.
At the end of my time as a flag officer aircraft carriers, I was sent as Director General Naval Manpower and Training. One of the things that I faced there was one of the inevitable kind of contractions in the size of our shore establishments to try and save money. And one of the things I did there was to close Burfield, which was the Wren's training establishment, and put it into Raleigh with the boys. And I remember the Chief Wren, in a great state of distress, saying, "You do realize that my girls are different from your boys." And I said, "Yes, I do. I do appreciate that. But I think that you'll find that although our chaps look pretty spotty to you, and pretty spotty to me, they might look quite good to your Wrens." But and the other thing I did was to abolish discharge by purchase. Now, this was something that had been going on since time immemorial. I mean, really, and it was totally out of date. I mean, in my time commanding ships, I'd had to face up to the fact that there was only one way for a disillusioned sailor to get out if he decided he didn't want to stay in the service anymore, and that was discharge by purchase. And that's going back to the slave trade almost. And furthermore, if it wasn't possible and it was a very narrow route out, then the only way you could get out was to go over the wall, in which case he'd eventually be arrested. He now had a criminal record, finish up in Colchester jail, and it was terrible. So I introduced what was called the notice engagement, which they still have, which said that if a chap gave 18 months notice that he wanted to leave, he could leave. All he did was give you 18 months notice, "I want to leave the Navy." And the 18 months was to ensure that you could finish out a commission or do a commission before the chap disappeared. And at the same time, as a disincentive, he went on to a lower rate of pay. And so he dropped his pay scale, but he was on notice and could leave at the end of 18 months. And I remember some people telling me, "Oh, the board will never go with this." But they did. And I remember them saying, "Well, I mean, I think it is very dangerous. Like, we may lose." I said, "Well, if we lose men, we deserve to lose them, because they obviously don't want to stay." That was my big achievement in being Director General of Foreign Training. And from that, I was promoted Vice Admiral and went as Vice Chief of the Naval Staff. And I was there at a time of considerable consolidation, in a way. I mean, every year the Naval, which is any measure of my success, the naval vote increased, which was one of the ways in which you measure whether you've been successful or not. We had several kind of inevitable episodes during that time, because it was again a Labour government. We were fortunate to have a very nice man, what's his name, as the Navy Minister, Patrick Duffy. And so we were fortunate there. Fortunate, I was then embroiled in the Cod War. And the Cod War was a very unpleasant affair. It was a war that, or a battle, or whatever you like to call it, that we couldn't win, because it was very obvious that public opinion and everything else was going to be against us, not in this country, but worldwide. And here was Goliath tackling, you know, the poor old Icelandic. Mother wasn't quite like that, because the Icelandic offshore patrol vessels were solid, built, rugged ships, whereas what we'd got up there to protect our trawlermen were these very advanced escorts, was designed for the Cold War. and very fragile, very thin-skinned, and so they were bound to suffer all kinds of danger and damage. Having said that, we had no option but to do it. I remember going to a meeting in the Ministry of Agriculture and Fisheries with the Navy, with the Secretary of State for the Minister for Defence, John Rogers. And, I mean, I've never been to such a meeting. I was up on the stage and all these trawlermen were shouting at the government and, And when we walked back, I remember saying to him, "Don't ever complain to me, Minister, about the way in which affairs are conducted in the Ministry of Defence." Because that was an absolute shambles this morning. He said, "Ray, you wait. If you go back there this afternoon after they've all had their beer and sandwiches, it'll be even worse." But it was a difficult one. In the height of this, I was due for leave, and I went on leave. And on Friday, on the television, when I turned it on when I got home, I saw that the usual kind of chaos was going on up there. But the First Sea Lord had said to me, "Now look, Ray, you're going to, you must go and leave. You must have your leave. You must go." So I did. But during that time, one of the guys that was up there had made a signal saying, "We are going to suffer unacceptable damage if we continue thwarting." And sad to relate, the First Sea Lord and had agreed that they made a signal which was tantamount to hoisting the white flag, because it said avoid damage. Well, you couldn't avoid damage if you know the Icelandic patrol boats very quickly realized that we were no longer going to stop them coming in and cutting the trawlers' nets, so they had effectively won. And when I got back, we had that very little tough little guy, the miner, ex-miner, who was now Secretary of State for Defence. And I was asked, "Well, I like it, but the Minister wants to see you, or the Secretary of State wants to see you. How can we rectify this situation?" And I said to him, "Well, I mean, it's going to be a lot worse now than it was before, because we should never have conceded. But having conceded, to get back in again is going to cost us a lot more damage than we might have suffered otherwise, but we have to do it." But I said, "Don't ask me to do it if you don't like the thought of blood on the carpet, because we may well suffer not only damage but injuries to our people." So at the same time, I authorised the fitting of some enormous railway tracks, bits of long bits of metal, onto the front of two diesel frigates that were then refitting or in maintenance at Chatham. And of course these things stuck out the front, and the idea was that we send them up there, and if the Icelandic gunboats came across cutting right across the bows, which was what they had been doing, then we would make a signal, "Uniform, you are standing into danger." And if they ignored that, then of course it would rip the bottom out of the things. So that was my counter. But before I could get to that stage, there had been a political settlement, and we effectively conceded the fact that they were allowed to extend their exclusion zone.
What tactics had they been employing against the trawler fleets?
Well, they were going in to cut the trawler's nets. And to do this, all they had to do was get close astern of the trawler, and they would cut the nets. And to get there, our job was to stop them getting there. And the only way you could stop them getting there was to put a physical presence between them and the trawler.
Would there ever been a question of an armed engagement at all?
I don't think it would ever have gone that far. I mean, no. I mean, the answer is, could you authorise them to open fire? I think that would have been, the whole world would have been against us, I think, if we'd done that. Because we could have done it and sorted the thing out very quickly. But it would not have satisfied the United Nations or anybody else, I suspect, at that time. But that was the major issue, really, when I was there, and life proceeded fairly normally. It's quite interesting, at that time we were looking at amalgamating the service training establishment. And I remember going to Shrivenham, that was when I was Director General of Naval Manpower Training, to talk to the Commandant of the General who was commanding Shrivenham. And I said, we can't go on with these single service training establishments. We're going to have to put them together. And I said, I don't care where they're put, because there'll be a rotating head. He said to me, you mean if it's Shrivenham, there would be an admiral in charge of it? So I said, on a rotating basis, yes. He said, never. Oh, well, that's the end of that discussion. But, of course, it's happened, as inevitably it had to. But there was a great deal of resistance against any kind of rationalization of resources at that time. And the getting together of the services, which again was inevitable. But anyway, so that was all part and parcel of the gay tapestry of life. And as I say, at that time, the procedure was that you went from being vice chief of the naval staff. Unless you'd done something bad, you'd go as Commander-in-Chief Fleet. And after Commander-in-Chief Fleet, you'd come back as First Sea Lord. And that was the plot. And one morning, John Treacher came to see me and said, I thought I ought to tell you, Ray, that I'm going to see the First Sea Lord. I said, oh yes. And he said, because I've got a young family and I have worked out the plot, and he obviously thought he was not going to be First Sea Lord for some reason. And he said, I want to leave the Navy and go and earn some money. So I'm going to ask the First Sea Lord if I can retire at the end of my time. But Edward Ashmore, being at Edward Ashmore, when this happened, said, yes, you can go now. Which meant that John Treacher was leaving much earlier than was expected. And so I'd only just been about 6 months as Vice Chief. And the First Sea Lord wouldn't let me go to be Commander in Chief Fleet. He wanted to keep me because he hadn't had all that much seagoing experience, whereas I'd had an enormous amount. So as a result, Admiral, who was then vice chief of the Defence Staff, was sent down to Squadron Chief Fleet, and there was then nowhere for me to go, except I could have gone as head of defence personnel, which was an opening, but I thought, no, I don't want to do that. So I decided, no, I'll go into industry myself, go outside, which, so sadly, in a way, I did. But as it turned out, I mean, I'm much better off than I would have been otherwise. So all's well that ends well, I suppose. But that's another chapter, and that is British Aerospace. Well, let's see. Well, I knew that there was nowhere that I wanted to go in the Navy, and I was going to leave. A year before I left, I wrote off to, well, the rather a somewhat sparse collection, although it turned out not to be, of contacts I knew, because I'd never been on the procurement side. So this was a saving grace, because a four-star had to have the Prime Minister's clearance before he could go into industry. So I wrote to Rolls-Royce, and I had a contact there. I wrote to British Aerospace, because there was Captain Drunkie Lewin was still there. I didn't really know him, but he was, you know, an acquaintance, if you like. I wrote to, General Electric, GEC, as it then was, Arnold Weinstock, whom I had met at a boardroom dinner. And I wrote to one of the Beltway Bandits in America, to go, which I had met earlier, and he was quite keen to have me. Anyway, time passed, and I pursued the contacts. Arnold wanted me to go down and run Frimley. I didn't quite understand that too much. Rolls-Royce wanted me to go and run their military aircraft division in America, because they were then selling became the AV-8B. The Beltway Bandit wanted me, but then I was some difficulty there about being a non-US citizen. And British Aerospace, in the shape of Frankie Lewin, arranged, I suppose, a kind of luncheon in which the then heads of the various parts of British Aerospace, which had only just been nationalised, were going to be there. George Jefferson and I can't remember now, isn't that terrible? The chaps were running the military division. George Jefferson ran the dynamics, and this other chap ran the military division. And so anyway, I had a lunch, and actually at that lunch I really gave them a rough time, because I said that from what I perceived of the Ministry of Defence, because the British defence industry had been so bad at coming up with the right solutions at the right cost at the right time, there was an increasing tendency to move towards America, buy things off the shelf, and it would put them out of business if they didn't clean up their act. Well, it was a pretty a strident performance, I suppose. But at any rate, I didn't realise it was in fact an interview for an employment. But it turned out to be all right, and I was then asked, I was given an opportunity from all these companies to join them. And I really didn't know what to do, and I was going down to South Central America to see my daughter and to be there for the birth of our first grandchild. And I was somewhat, indeterminate, I suppose, about what I should be doing. And I remember saying to my wife just before we were, I said, I don't know what to do. I said, do you want to go and live in America? And she said, no, I want to do whatever you want to do. Whatever you want to do is fine with me. So I then said, well, I think I'll go with British Aerospace. I didn't quite know why, but I did. And the next thing that happened after that, when George Jefferson said to me, well, you will never regret it. Well, I don't know what that means. I didn't really understand what I was supposed to do. I was to go as a director of the Dynamics Group, as it then was. And so I eventually arrived and went to the Dynamics Group. And it was a board meeting, and I walked in. I was introduced and was told, sit down, shut up. And I looked around the rest of these chaps, and it was very clear to me that none of them knew that I was going to be appointed. I mean, so after that, I went to see George Jefferson. I said, what do you want me to do? And he said, well, I want you to do two things. I want you to pursue lightweight Sea Wolf, which is going into the Type 21 frigates when they're modernized, and also to take a look at the Hatfield-Lostock division of Dynamics to see what you think of it. So I said, well, as far as the first one is concerned, you are wasting your time, because we have cancelled the modernization of the Type 21s. And he said, oh no, I've been told by Bath, that is not so. And I said, well, I'm telling you, I've just come from being Vice Chief of the Naval Staff, and look at the chap, and First Sea Lord, you look at the chap who actually did it, because we just have no capacity. So, and I say it's a great shame, because Lightweight Sea Wolf would be a marvellous thing to have, but the fact is that we haven't gone down that route. So he said, well, anyway, we're going to pursue it. I thought, well, good luck to you. And the other thing, it was to look at Hatfield-Lostock Division. So I thought, right, well, then I can do it. So I went down to Hatfield and had a presentation by the chap who was running Hatfield about what they were doing. And then I went up to Lostock. It was a long trip, driving up with my wife, and there was to be a dinner at the last drop-in up there in Bolton or wherever it is. I finally found it, and Drunkie Lewin was going to be there, and he obviously was very concerned about my meeting the pair that were known subsequently as the Robber Barons of the North, which was the two chaps who were running the Lostock manufacturing site. It was an enormous site which had produced thousands of propellers during the war. Anyway, that seemed to go all right, and so after, I suppose it was about 2 weeks, I thought, well, I don't know. So I went back to see George Jefferson, and I said, well, you know my views on the lightweight Seawolf. There's nothing more I can tell you on that. As far as the second thing you asked me to do, I've done that. But you have a problem. And he said, what is it? And I said, well, there's nobody running it. I said, you've got two separate, well, three with Stevenage site, and one in London. I said, and they're not connected in any way. And he said, I know. I thought, well, if you know, what the hell am I supposed to be doing? So I said, well, he said, what do you think we should do? And I said, well, you're going to have to put somebody in charge of it. He said, yes, but who? And I said, well, I don't know. I only just walked into this company. I said, but you must have half a dozen chaps you could put in charge of it. He said, that's the trouble, I don't have. And I said, you don't have anybody? And he said, no. So there was a silence, and I said, well, would you like me to try to do it? And he said, yes, I would. And I said, well, I can give you no guarantees. I said, I've never run a commercial organization before. I've run large organizations, but not a commercial one. But I will just do my best. That's all I can say. And he said, that's good enough. So he said, I'll appoint you next Monday. I call a board meeting at Hatfield, and I'll make the announcement. I said, well, right. And he went down there. I know he went down there on the Friday before, and I thought he'd gone down to alert them all to the fact that I was coming in as their new managing director. But when I walked in on Monday morning, I sat down, he said, he was the chairman, he said, right, first of all, he said, I'd like to say that I'm appointing a new managing director. It is Admiral Sir Raymond Ligo. It's all yours, Ray. He got up and walked out. And I was left sitting looking at this lot, who were all staring goggle-eyed at me. And I said, well, let me tell you something. I said, I can't believe that the Royal Navy would have to go outside to find somebody to run one of its major divisions. I can't see why it's had to happen in British Aerospace, but let me assure you, it will never happen again as far as I'm concerned. And of course, it didn't happen again. I was very careful to make sure I had people that grew up inside the company to do to replace me. Anyway, I then set to work at Hatfield. I was not warmly welcomed, may I say. I mean, I think it was overtly said, but you know, one could sense the atmosphere. But I was fortunate enough to inherit Drunky Lewin's secretary, Olive Tregellis, who was a marvellous help to me. And I mean, all started very simply. Here was the managing director, and I was quite determined I was going to get the best office there. But of course, it was all occupied already. So they had to be told that they have to move. Because I was offered an office at the back somewhere, and I said, no, thank you, I'll take this front one. And so we gradually started. And our first, then I went through this, but it's all in my book, of saying to the then general manager, now I'd like to talk to everybody. And he didn't understand that quite clearly. I didn't realize at the time. And he said, right, I'll call a meeting of the board. All right. So we called a board meeting, and I talked to them about what I saw the problem was and what strengths I could bring. And when I'd done that, I said, now I want to talk to everybody. He always said, I'll call a meeting of the funny things that happened during the nationalized period and that wage restraint period. Because the way they got round it was to keep inventing new levels of management so that they could justify a raise in pay. So they said, I'll call a meeting of the management committee. So, right, so that they all fell in, and I told them the same story. And then I said, now I'd like to speak to everybody. And said, oh, well, I'll call a meeting of the unions. So they thought, I don't believe this. So then I spoke to the unions, and then when they finished, I said, now I want to speak to everybody. And he said, but do you do realize that we've got 1,200 people on the site? And I said, yes. I had 2,600 in Ark Royal, and I spoke to all of them in one heap, and I intend to do the same thing here. And he said, well, I don't think we've got a space big enough to... I mean, it was quite incredible. They were determined that I shouldn't do it. And I said, well, we'll wait for nice weather and I'll do it in the open air then. But, of course, it was found that if they cleaned the canteen out of a bit, there would be plenty of room there. And the great moment arrived, and it was going to... I was going to talk to them at, I think, 4 o'clock on a Friday. And everybody packed up at Upper Four, and he, just before the meeting, he said, oh, by the way, I should warn you, the secretaries are allowed to leave 15 minutes early, so they'll probably walk out in the middle of your talk. So I said, oh, well, I'll just have to see what happens. And at 4 o'clock, when I went into there, there I was with my secretary and the general manager and a podium and a microphone and not a soul. And 4 o'clock came and not a soul. And I thought, Bligo, you have blown it. But then I saw doors opening all around the place and people starting to come out. And by 4:10, they were all in there. And so I gave them the same story once again, of who I was and what I was and what I thought of them and what I thought I could produce and what we could do together. And nobody left. And at 4:30, when I'd finished, I received a round of applause, and nobody tried to walk out. And they were all thoroughly impressed because it had never happened before. The communications facilities between management and their people was non-existent. And this was something clearly that had to be rectified forthwith. There was no point in hanging about. And so I proceeded to go walk about and visit various places, talk to people and in their benches and in their offices, and generally begin to break down this dreadful kind of division there was between management and the rest of the workforce. And I mean, there were some pathetic stories that have been... I remember one chap who was sitting and talking to him. He said, you know, I've been in this company for 40 years, and this is the first time I've ever spoken to a member of management, leave alone the chief executive. And I was then a managing director of this division. But it happened. Now, that was my major concern, was to break down this division so that we had a community that was working together to achieve whatever its objectives were, which basically was to produce good missiles for the Navy and the Army and the Air Force, and to produce them to time and to cost. Now, one of the things that was very clear to me at the beginning was that the only way I was going to do this was to go for fixed-price contracts. This would present a kind of discipline to the organization, which up to then had been lacking. The problem that I had, of course, was that we were nationalized, and we were running very rapidly at that time. I'd only been there a few months, and the election was due, and the Conservatives had said that if they were elected, they were going to privatize British airspace, amongst other things. I therefore said to one of my colleagues on the board, and I should explain, that when I was told when I joined British Aerospace by Lord Beswick, who was the chairman, that I should join the board of British Aerospace, I said, thank you very much, sir, but I'm afraid that will not be possible, because I believe that if I join the board of a nationalised company, I shall lose my naval pension, and that I'm not prepared to do. So, and he said, oh, well, I'm sure we can sort that out. But, of course, they couldn't. And the anomaly was that Hull & Wolfe at Belfast, or Belfast, whatever they called themselves in those days, the chief executive was a retired civil servant, but he didn't have to give up his pension. Why? Because they weren't nationalised. They were wholly owned, but they weren't nationalised. And it was just one of these bureaucratic quirks. So I said to Lord Beswick, well, I'll tell you what, I said, I'll attend board meetings, if you like, but you won't pay me as a member of the board, but I'll be there so that you can have the benefit, or whatever it is, of my experience. So that was what was agreed. So I used to attend these board meetings, but I wasn't officially a board member. And on one of these occasions, I said to one of the chaps, I said, are we going to discuss the question of privatisation? And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, if the Conservatives win the next election, and all the opinion polls show that they will, then we're going to be privatised. And how are we going to face that? I said, I think we should discuss it. Or he said, I don't think so. He said, it would upset the chairman. I said, well, he's going to be upset sooner or later, that's for sure. So at the moment, nobody would raise it. So at the next board meeting, under any other business, I said, yes, sir, I have some business. What is this board's attitude going to be if the Conservative Party win the next election and they privatise this company? And Aaron Bezick looked at me fixedly and said, I don't wish to discuss that. And I said, then you are wrong. You are completely wrong. You are absolutely